The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, the latest on health and healing. And if you should have to be in a situation where you're exposed to radiation, what can you do to protect yourself? Not necessarily the meltdown of a nuclear power plant, but how about chest x-rays or going through one of the x-ray machines in the airport? I'll give you the latest on protecting yourself. Commentary from Professor Paul Craig Roberts on 9/11 After a Decade, What Have We Learned? My guest in the third part of our program today will be Susan Lindauer. Unheeded warning signs about 9/11 and a look at the terrorists behind the Patriot Act. You heard me right, the terrors behind the Patriot Act. Then from Richard Clark, how oligopoly plus oligarchy is leading to corporate communism in America. And finally, Matt Tabibi, Obama goes all out for dirty banker deals. Why are we not surprised? Let's begin. We have a lot to cover. I want to give you as much as possible. Lots of information. When I look at any issue, I try to always break it down in its components. For example, all the people running for president, right now no independents as such, but all Republicans on the other side right now, uncontested, at least at this point, is Obama. And people position themselves generally on certain issues. And the Republicans bend over backwards to see who is the most conservative or representing what we consider conservative values. But that in itself is where it ends for most people. I like to see the specifics. I like to break everything into a piece of a puzzle and then re-examine it. For example, let's just take one example. Rick Perry. Now, what does this have to do with health? It has everything to do if you take the time to study the details. Why? Because Rick Perry has done more to harm the immune systems of young individual women in Texas than any other legislator in the state's history. How so? Well, let me give you some specifics. He has a history. Back in February 2007, as governor of Texas, he issues an executive order, and that executive order bypassed the will of the Texas people and the entire legislature. It mandated that vaccinations with the Gardasil from grade 6 in Texas, and you couldn't opt out of it. Now, why is that important? Because Merck, the pharmaceutical company that has a terrible history, just the worst history. It was the chief distributor of the vaccine. And it's the same drug company that also had given thousands upon thousands of dollars to Perry's campaign efforts. Now, according to Christina Luisa, Natural News, this is what she just reported. She said, quote, Rick Perry has shown himself to be the most duplicitous, deceptive politician that I've ever studied in the history of the United States. I don't know about that. There are a lot of bad politicians in history. That was according to Alex Jones, who has his own point of view on this. But to his credit, Alex Jones has done more airtime than anyone except ourselves on challenging the safety and efficacy of vaccines and pharmaceuticals in general. And he looked at this. Now, the vaccine was given FDA approval in June of 2006. Immediately, it was put on the market. There were not adequate long-term studies done at all. Quite simply, it was a human experimentation. And only 8 months later, Governor Perry signed that executive order mandating this vaccine to all young girls. And later, young boys were also made to take the vaccine, though it has absolutely zero benefit for them. Many of us feel that the left and the right have betrayed the American public by going along with corporate-sponsored legislation. Now we have more of the knowledge of how this happens, that the Alec conventions where all the members of state legislatures or most meet with members of corporate America. They decide what law should be implemented, what law should be rescinded, what rules should be changed. The legislators then go back into their state legislatures and propose laws or amendments or changes that we are led to believe they created, not at all. And then, of course, the corporations of ALEC then give these people financial support. Now we know the truth of it. So we know that these vaccines do not have the safety and efficacy to back them up. And yet they will not debate this in open forums. Instead, they tend to attack anyone who challenges vaccine safety and efficacy as conspiratorialists. To the contrary, now, although there are now 25 million people in the state of Texas, as a justification for this vaccine and his actions, Perry reported that there were only 391 deaths of women by cervical cancer, which would not have proved to be caused by the human papillomavirus to begin with. So he's wrong on all levels. Governor Perry knowingly lied and told Texas families that he had the power to force their young girls to be vaccinated with Gardasil, the same vaccine that he knew was killing people in the few test trials that were run on it. Not only was this fraud of a vaccine completely worthless as a medical method meant to protect girls from cervical cancer, it was obviously lethal, a fact that was proven after there were countless cases of adverse reactions and multiple deaths reported after the vaccine was administered. In fact, only 4 months after Perry signed his order for mandated Gardasil vaccines, there were 13 cases of adverse vaccine reactions reported to the VARS system. That's the vaccine adverse reporting system. There were thousands more negative reactions reported that were never touched by the mainstream media. That alone should have caused Perry to rescind his executive order. But didn't happen. So now what's the likelihood that almost any drug that comes out, or any vaccine, no matter how ludicrous, they could come out with an AIDS vaccine and mandate that every American, to protect every other American, should be vaccinated with an AIDS vaccine? Well, that's what happens when you've accepted money from the pharmaceutical industry. Then you have to keep accepting it. So there's a lot of dirty money. In effect, Perry is Big Pharma's go-to person. And one of the main Merck lobbyists, Mike Toomey, served as Perry's chief of staff. In other words, a former man of top power for the governor now works for Merck, the same pharmaceutical company that funded the campaign for Perry. We've already seen what happens when the banks fund a legislator. We see when the people like from Congressman Dodd from Connecticut and Barney Frank and others get money, suddenly their legislation goes easy or gives a pass to people. We have no real bank regulation. We have no Wall Street financial industry regulation. We have never stopped the derivative wild casino legislation. None of this exists. And so anyone can do anything they want as long as they have the power to do so and can reach out and put some money in some congressperson's pockets. So that's just an example of why even the people that we are voting for and we think would be good, who owns them? Because if you watch now who's putting money in their pocket, you'll absolutely know what their reactions are going to be later when we say there's a toxic drug there. And they say, well, it's not really proven to be toxic, and we need more studies. And you're right back to Vioxx again. That was killed 60,000 Americans. Not a single person was held accountable. If Perry's elected, or any other legislator that takes money from Big Pharma, that's exactly what you can expect. Now, adding on a little bit more on the vaccines, most of the vaccines contain polysorbate 80. What do we now know about polysorbate 80? It can cause anaphylactic shock. This is the latest from Bridget Shaw. It says, add anaphylactic shock to the long list of disastrous effects of vaccinations. A recent article in VacTruth.com identifies a potentially fatal allergic reaction as one of the consequences of polysorbate 80, a chemical found in many vaccines, including the flu and human papillomavirus vaccines. German researchers have identified polysorbate 80 as the cause of an anaphylactic reaction in a patient, which can include, quote, Polysorbate 80 is a solubilized agent that can cause severe non-immunologic anaphylactic reactions, unquote. And that could also kill you. So one more reason why we do not have anything remotely resembling a healthy vaccine in the United States. Now, what do we do if we are exposed to radiation in any form, or we get to where we actually have some radiation poisoning? One of the things we should do is examine homeopathy. Dane Allman's been on this program in the past many times. He is one of America's leading homeopaths, and he suggests, and I agree, that homeopathy is the way to go. In fact, clear back in 1896, a Dr. Grube was a student of Hahnemann Medical College of Chicago, a famous homeopathic medical school at that time, and he gave radiation treatment to a woman with breast cancer. And he got the idea of using radiation as a treatment for breast cancer from Reuben Ludlam, a medical doctor, his professor at the homeopathic medical school. Ludlam knew that Grube had previously experimented with x-rays as a diagnostic procedure so often that he developed blisters and tumors on his hands and neck as a result of the exposure to this technology. And because one of the basic premises of homeopathic medicine is that small doses of a treatment can help to heal those symptoms that a large doses are known to cause, Ludlam suggested to Grube that radiation may be a treatment for conditions such as tumors because it also causes them. This incident is but one more example from history in which an insight from a homeopathic perspective has provided an important breakthrough in medical treatment. Even though Grube had to have one of his hands amputated early in life due to the high exposures received from his early experiences with radiation, he ultimately lived to be 85 years of age, in part due to the homeopathic treatment he received throughout his life. He also had a long and distinguished career as a professor of electrotherapeutics and radiation at Hahnemann Medical College. So now, what would that be if you took a homeopathic remedy that had radiation in it, or that would affect radiation? Well, with the media concerned about radiation drift from Japan and the real and exaggerated fears that many people are experiencing now, the first homeopathic medicine that people today may consider taking is Arsenicum Album 30C. Arsenicum Album, A-L-B-U-M. It's a leading homeopathic medicine for anxiety and fear, especially around health issues and about being poisoned. Taking a single dose whenever you notice those strong emotional states is reasonable, but you only have to take it once. And then, of course, the CDC is recommending potassium iodide. Okay, well, that may protect the thyroid gland, but that doesn't protect the rest of the body, and when you get radiation, you're going to get it all over the place in every tissue of your body. Potassium iodide seems to only protect against iodine-related radiation. There's cesium, strontium, nitrogen, tritium radiation. And further, the Japanese are working to reduce radiation emissions by dousing a container with graphite and borax, both of which can change the nature of the emissions. So what else could we do? Well, there's several things you can do. So write these down, because these can all be important. Aside from Arsenicum Album, you can also take, these are derived from a homeopathic literature. Now, mind you, these don't have any radiation actually in them. They have been diluted to the point where there is none. For example, ginseng 6X to 200X. And Ruta, R-U-T-A, G-R-A-V-E-O-L-N-S, 30X, when administered before and after exposure, compared to mice that were given just a placebo for treatment in this particular experiment, there was significant protection. There was less chromosomal and cellular damage. Ginseng 30X and 200X in particular had significant and substantial benefits. In addition to the evidence for the benefits from homeopathic doses of ginseng, is other research testing crude doses in which we find that it repairs DNA after radiation. In another study, albino guinea pigs were exposed to small doses of X-rays that caused reddening of the skin. Studies showed that homeopathic honeybee, which is Apis, A-P-I-S, mellifica, M-E-L-L-I-F-I-C-A, 7C or 9C, had a protective effect and a roughly 50% curative effect on X-ray-induced redness of the skin. By the way, the Apis mellifica has long been known in homeopathic medicine to remove redness, swelling, and itching, all of which are common symptoms that crude doses of bee venom cause. Thus, homeopathic doses will be found to be effective in treating these symptoms. Now, derived from the homeopathic literature and clinical experience over the past 100 years, some of the potential homeopathic remedies for radiation exposure would include radium bromatum, that's R-A-D-I-U-M, B-R-O-M-A-T-U-M, and strontium carbonicum, C-A-R-B-O-N-I-C-U-M, and calendula ointment, cadmium sulfurnicum, C-A-D-M-I-U-M, S-U-L-P-H-U-R-A-T-U-M. Those are some of the best. In fact, cadmium iodatum, I-O-D-A-T-U-M, might be considered for those people exposed to radiation who did not protect the thyroid gland with the potassium iodide. And so those are just some good things that we can do. I'm Gary Knoll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Our guests in a moment. Just a few things to share before then. I'm concerned about Obama's appointment as our new job czar. The General Electric chairman, Jeff Immelt. Now, he was chosen to create jobs in the United States. Good. But it turns out General Electric is planning to move its 115-year-old X-ray division from Wisconsin to Beijing. In addition to moving the headquarters, the company will invest $2 billion in China and train more than 65 engineers and create 6 research centers. This is the same GA that made $5.1 billion in the United States last year but paid no income tax at all. And they now are employing more people overseas than in the United States. So, President Obama, exactly why didn't you choose someone who actually would create jobs in America and who's not known for outsourcing American jobs? I see. You don't want to break your string of behavior. Okay. And you know the Democrats are going to ultimately agree that, well, better him than anyone on the right. Sure. My guests are on standby. Before we go to them, this is our commentary and issue segment. This will come after my guest, so if you'd like to call in after the guest and share your points of view, I'm going to give you a couple now. First, from my guest, before we go to her, and she is Susan Lindauer. Just a little background. Susan is a former U.S. intelligence asset who covered anti-terrorism at the Iraqi embassy in New York from 1996 up to the invasion. Now, independent sources have confirmed that she gave advanced warning about the 9/11 attack. She also started talks with the Lockerbie trial, for the Lockerbie trial with Libyan diplomats, and shortly after requesting to testify before Congress about successful elements of pre-war intelligence, she became one of the very first non-Arab Americans arrested on the Patriot Act as an Iraqi agent. She was accused of warning her second cousin, White House Chief of Staff Andrew Card, and Secretary of State Colin Powell that war with Iraq would have catastrophic consequences. And so we're going to talk with her. Here's something she had to say. This is just a brief intro. I'm not going through the whole article. When I recall the summer of 2001, in our last days of innocence before 9/11 attack, I often think of Guy Clark's old song, Like Desperados Waiting for a Train. I remember the heartbeat of it vividly. That's because our team gave advance warnings about the 9/11 attack in precision detail. On command of my CIA handler, I also delivered threats to Iraqi diplomats at the United Nations of the consequence of war should Baghdad withhold actionable intelligence about the 9/11 conspiracy. Throughout that hot summer, we understood exactly how 9/11 would play out, with airplane hijackings and a strike on the World Trade Center. We had a good idea of the timing, and we projected the use of miniature thermonuclear devices. Yet for all that we tried, we could not stop it. Forces had been set in motion, responsive agents and actions to our urgent appeals for help, which should have been automatic but ignored. Above all, we could not fathom that another competing team would sneak in and wire explosives to bring down the towers. And that's exactly what happened. We shouted from the rooftops. We joked in phone conversations that the NAC, the National Security Agency, should wake up and pick up the phones. You guys at NAC have been tapping our phones for years so you could catch this call. Don't sleep through it. Hello, NASA. Pick up the phones. When new neighbors showed up with a moving van that July 1st, I joked that they might go back where they came from if they heard our conversation about this World Trade Center attack. After 9/11, I wept for those conversations. By August, our team was so anxious about the imminent timing of the attack that my CIA handler, Dr. Richard Fuchs, instructed me to go to the extra mile to notify the Justice Department and the White House, so both sides of the intelligence and law enforcement could mobilize together to block it. Our actions that August will be outlined in the next article. I put our team, including Dr. Richard Fuchs and Paul Hoven, at the eye of the storm that would become the 9/11 cover-up. Our efforts robbed the Bush administration of deniability, making us a serious threat to the story they desired to sell on the Fox News Channel and the Sunday morning talk shows. Notoriously, I would get slapped with the Patriot Act and locked in prison on Carswell Air Force Base in Texas. When incarceration failed to break my spirit or frighten me out of speaking, they threatened me with forcible drugging, with Haldol, Ativan, and Prozac to chemically lobotomize me into silence. Because truth does matter, so much of America's national security and terrorism policy has been predicated on mistaken assumptions about that day. Ignorance has inflicted a terrible cost on American foreign policy, pushing the United States into two catastrophic wars and drowning our middle class in red ink and deficit spending to beef up profit margins for defense contractors. Once Americans understand 9/11 as a collision of special interest, our country should be able to sweep away the false construct that has become the war on terrorism. We should be free to create a more effective strategy for protecting our nation's security without exaggerating threats and manufacturing fresh hostilities against us. That's one. This is a separate one. And then we go to our guest. In a few days, it will be the 10th anniversary of September 11th, 2001. How well has the U.S. government's official account of the event held up over the decade? Not very well. The chairman, vice chairman, and senior legal counsel for the 9/11 Commission wrote books partially disassociating themselves with the commission's report. They said that the Bush administration put obstacles in their path. that information was withheld from them, that President Bush agreed to testify only if he was chaperoned by Vice President Cheney, and neither were put under oath. The Pentagon and FAA officials lied to the commission, and that the commission considered referring the false testimony for investigation for obstruction of justice. In their book, the chairman and vice chairman of the 9/11 Commission, Thomas Kane and Lee Hamilton, wrote that the 9/11 Commission was, quote, set up to fail, unquote. Senior counsel John Farmer Jr. wrote that the U.S. government, quote, made a decision not to tell the truth about what happened, and that the NORAD tapes told a radically different story from what had been told to us and the public. We, to this day, don't know why NORAD told us what they told us. It was just so far from the truth, unquote. Most of the questions from the 9/11 families were not answered. Important witnesses were not called. The commission only heard from those who supported the government's account. The commission was a controlled political operation, not an investigation of events and evidence. Its membership consisted of former politicians. No knowledgeable experts were appointed to the commission. One member of the 9/11 commission, former Senator Max Cleland, responded to the constraints placed on the commission by the White House. Quote, if this decision stands, I as a member of the commission cannot look any American in the eye, especially family members of victims, and say the commission had full access. This investigation is now compromised, unquote. Cleveland resigned rather than have his integrity compromised. One would think that a handful of Arabs managed to outwit not merely the CIA, the FBI, but all 16 U.S. intelligence agencies. All intelligence agencies of our allies, including Mossad, the National Security Council, the State Department, NORAD, airport security four times in one morning, air traffic control, etc. The President, Congress, and the media would be demanding to know how such an improbable event could occur. Instead, the White House put up a wall of resistance to finding out, and Congress and the media showed no interest. During the decade that has passed, numerous 9/11 truth organizations have formed. There are architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth, firefighters for 9/11 Truth, pilots for 9/11 Truth, scholars for 9/11 Truth. Remember Building7.org and a New York group which includes 9/11 families. These groups all call for a real investigation. David Ray Griffin has written 10 carefully researched books documenting problems in the government's account. Scientists have pointed out that the government has no explanation for the molten steel. In fact, they've been forced to admit that the World Trade Center building number 7 was in free fall for part of its descent. And a scientific team led by a professor of nanochemistry at the University of Copenhagen, who we've had on this program several times, has reported finding nanothermite in the dust from the building. Larry Silverstein, who had the lease on the World Trade Center building, said in a PBS broadcast the decision was made, quote, to pull, unquote, Building 7 late in the afternoon, 9/11. Chief fire marshals have said that no forensic investigation was made of the buildings. Destruction was not investigated. And in point of fact, absence of an investigation was a violation of the law. Some efforts have been made to explain away some of the evidence that is contrary to the official account, but most of the contrary evidence is simply ignored. The fact remains that the skepticism of a large number of knowledgeable experts has gone nowhere, and the Obama administration is chief among the defenders of the official government report. The practice now is brand any expert not convinced by the government's case as a conspiracy theorist. But of course, the government's own theory is a conspiracy theory, and even less likely one once a person realizes full implications of intelligence operation. Moreover, what do 1,500 architects and engineers have to gain from being ridiculed as conspiracy theorists? They certainly will never receive another government contract, and many surely lost business as a result of their anti-American stance. But it wasn't anti-American. They were called anti-American because they challenged the government. Their competitors must have had a heyday out of their, quote, unpatriotic doubts. Scientists have even less incentive to express any doubts, which probably explains why there are not 1,500 physicists for 9/11 truth. Few physicists have careers independent of government contracts and grants. It was a high school physics teacher who forced the government to abandon its account of Building Number 7's demise. Physicist Stephen Jones, who we've also had on this program, who first reported finding evidence of explosives, had his tenure bought out by the university because of this. Also, we had a woman scientist on this program who said that she had absolute irrefutable concrete proof that steel beams simply became dust. They evaporated, not based upon heat, but based upon a change of energy. I believe that both she is correct and those who believe thermitic explosions are correct. I believe it was a redundant setup, meaning whoever was behind this had to have a failsafe, and hence the failsafe. That is what we're going to be going into in a moment with my guest, who is standing by, Susan Lindauer. But first, I'm on location, and don't have a cell phone, don't even have a computer, so it doesn't do any good to. Judy Wood was the person, the scientist I had on talking about the building dissolving. In any case, a lot of people saw in the news yesterday that the most winning coach, basketball coach in American history, even more than John Wooden or anyone else, now has been diagnosed with advanced dementia and Alzheimer's. And then they had a person on, and I just saw it this morning because someone in my office sent it to me on a hookup of the person on the network news saying, well, but there's no treatment, there's nothing that can help a person with Alzheimer's, all they can do is make them comfortable. And they are correct. They're 100% correct. There's absolutely nothing anyone in official medicine can do. But that's their point of view. Standing by for a moment or two to offer some hope to this woman. If anyone in this audience wants to take this information and reach out to her, please do so. I'm not able to, based upon my schedule, my filming, my travel, and all that I'm doing. I'm on 720 as it is now. But I have Dr. Howard Robbins on the line, and I have Marie McGovern on the line. Let's go to Marie McGovern first. How are you today, Marie? Marie?
Hello. My name is Marie McGovern. A few years ago, after suffering Alzheimer's and being totally incapacitated, I was referred to Dr. Robbins on Dr. Null's referral to receive direct intravenous ozone therapy. And with Dr. Robbins' meticulous monitoring of my ozone dosages and my strictly adhering to Dr. Null's nutritional protocol, I've reversed many of the effects, as you can probably hear. It's an ongoing, truly an ongoing, and it's, I am very, very, very pleased. It's hard work, but the alternative of being almost unconscious and unresponsive is a situation. I'm terrified.
Marie, let me ask you a few quick, short questions, all right?
Sure. I just wanted to say I'm really grateful for being given back the gift of life again from you and Dr. Robbins.
All right. Were you treated at the Rush Center down at New York University?
I was treated, yes, not only for RUSC for rehabilitation, but I was in a study for Alzheimer's, and I was diagnosed.
Were you not also treated at Columbia University?
No, I was not treated at Columbia University for Alzheimer's. I was treated at NYU and diagnosed at NYU. I had stopped by Columbia, and they didn't really do anything.
All right. During your career, you had a very broad-based career. You taught at New York University, correct?
Yes, I was an adjunct professor at NYU. I have been a curator for very, very large firms at Willis Kroon, which is a division of Lloyd's. It goes on and on.
All right, so you had a long and distinguished career. When you first came that day at 92nd Street for our first Healing the Brain mental health support group, how far along in your Alzheimer's condition and symptoms were you?
Well, I was brought because I couldn't even, not saying that I had no ADLs. I couldn't wash myself, take care of myself.
How long would it be in between showers or baths?
I don't want to discuss that. I mean, it's very hard to describe how far down. I couldn't even follow the continuity of the television program. So you can imagine that my sense of time and ability to take care of myself was zero.
So you were at the end of your capacity to maintain any quality of life at all?
Yes, I was.
I believe you told me you were simply, you would go from the bed to the couch, and you were waiting.
Yes, from the bed to the couch, the couch to the bed, the bed to the couch,
and
the couch.
And you were simply waiting to die.
Yes.
Okay.
Because that's what I was told was my alternative.
So with a very comprehensive program, and it is comprehensive and diligently followed, how are you today compared to what you were, let's say, 4 years ago?
It's, you know, part of what you know, I walk to all my appointments. Back then I didn't, you know, if I was brought to some place, I didn't know where I was going. I walked to all my appointments. I handled all my affairs, my billing, my administration. I have a rich life where I bring people, disabled people, to the museum. I have a full and rich life. I have a happy life. I'm very grateful for this life. I, you know, take care of all my affairs independently.
So in other words, you have your life back again instead of being otherwise what might be without a life.
Yeah, I've even developed, I would say, a deeper spiritual and deeper emotional life, as well as, I I'm very selective in what I read, and I'm constantly upgrading my intellectual abilities.
So let's say you could take a group to a museum and have the same type of in-depth historical discussion on the nature of the artist that you used to do. You do that today?
I don't generally do that with people because I'm taking disabled people.
But could you do it?
I'm pretty good. Yeah, I'm pretty good.
So you can read anything
today? If they
today?
Ask the questions, I generally can respond to it,
okay.
In an intelligent way. People say that they enjoy what I say.
All right. Are you aware of anyone else in the United States or any of the Alzheimer's support groups you were in who have made the progress and changes you have?
Well, I know I was set up for an Elan study where five people at Massachusetts General died and three at NYU. And luckily, my friends snatched me out of that. So I'm alive today to be part of your protocol. I've been in Alzheimer's groups at museums where they just, you know, have you drawing pictures and things like that with people who have digressed, and I really don't know what's happened to them. They haven't done very well.
Okay, but we have.
I have talked with people I've worked with through the years about your protocol, and I see people, a movement growing where people are improving, that I talk to, who are part of what I'm doing.
They're improving not because of the orthodox treatment. Let me just, because I'm going to go to my guest, and I appreciate you sharing this. Here's a woman who today, in all likelihood, would be dead. She's Marie McGovern. Would you agree or disagree with that, Marie?
I agree emphatically with it.
Okay, who's not only alive, but you would have to see the first video we did of her, where she was slurring and drooling. It was very challenging, very difficult. And when you see the changes she has made, the courage she has, the strength of character she has, the discipline she has, she is unwavering in this. Today she has her life back, and she's helping others get their life back from other conditions. And she was in a group where there was an advanced multiple sclerosis person named Kenny. You remember Kenny?
Yes, Kenny's done very, very well.
Did you hear Kenny last week say in front of a group where we were filming that he is completely cured of his MS?
He went from doing plumbing work to doing high-end HVAC and CAD work since I've known him. That's a big, giant leap.
And from when I first saw him, the first day you came, we had to help him up the steps because he couldn't use a lot of his muscles, and the neurologist said it was not reversible. Well, today, the same neurologist can find nothing with all their tests in him. So what I'm saying is this. The next time we hear that there's a well-known person suffering from a condition and they're going to say there's nothing we can do except giving them some meds to keep them calm or make them comfortable, understand they are right and they are wrong. They are right, they can't do anything. They're wrong, we have and do daily, regularly. So I thank you for, and give us, anyone who wants to speak with you, let them have your number or how to reach you.
Sure, you can call me at 212-645-3490. I'll then refer you to professionals. I'm just going to tell you my story. Medical professionals that I've been connected with through Gary that handled this. I can only tell you my story, and I think that
Marie, do you realize that you're Bannister? Do you ever hear of Bannister who broke the 4-minute mile? Absolutely.
I'm not the only one, though. There's other people now who are doing it.
Yeah, every expert said that it couldn't be done. Then it got done. Then within a couple of weeks, other people did it. So we have now an example, a human being who's done something medicine says can't be done, science says can't be done. You're an example. It was done, is done. Others are we could bring forward. So reach out to this woman coach if anyone wants to and let her know. Let her speak with Marie McGovern. If they want the protocols, I'm happy to help. Howard Robbins on the line. Howard?
Hi, Gary.
Hi.
You know, the difficult we do immediately, the impossible takes just a little longer, was an expression back in World War II. But we've been doing that, you and I, for years now. By people following the nutritional protocols that you prescribed, which are probably the most complete nutritional protocols anybody could ever hope to dream up or come up with, in addition to the direct intravenous ozone therapy, cleanses the body and detoxes the body so completely of metals, viruses, bacterias, just about everything that doesn't belong in there is removed. We give people back their life. We change families. Families get, I mean, Kenny got, his wife got back a husband. His 4-year-old daughter got back a father who's now a functional man in society. He's working full time as a plumber doing all sorts of solar electrical work and things like that that are very complicated. And he could hardly walk when he came in. And Marine was virtually, with all due respect, what's called a vegetable. And we turned her around completely, and relatively speaking, in a short time, in just months. It didn't take years to turn her around. It took months to turn her around. Can't make promises and guarantees to results to everybody listening out there like this. But the truth is, they will be our first failures, and I can't see any reason why we would fail with anyone at this point in time.
Well, because we're working from a different paradigm, and you can't understand it. You can only be critical of it and deny it unless you are part of it. So, Howard, I've got to go. My guests have been holding, but I had so many people evidently contact my office in New York. I'm not there. I can't get the communications. I'm filming. And I want them to know that, yes, we could help. We could help. And I'm on the road. If anyone wants to reach out.
Let them call me, Gary.
Let them call you.
212-581-0101. I'll take the calls. I'll handle it for us.
Okay, because I'm
God
not able to be reached.
Dr. Robbins, Dr. Null, God bless you.
Thank you, Maureen. Maureen McGovern, next time someone says nothing can be done, they're wrong. She's there. Now, they can deny her, but we've got all of her medical records. We've got all of her diagnosis. We've got all the years she spent fruitlessly seeking their treatment. That means she would have some terrific lawsuits against all the people who claim that they were treating her if they try to get into... You know what they'll do? They go through this denial. Well, she must not have had it. I've heard that so many times. You cure someone of a terminal illness, they must not have had it. Oh, yeah, they do. And we're meticulous in making sure that we film them, get their medical records, get all the documentation before we start this journey of healing. Anyhow, at least there's hope now. Thank you all. Let's go over and say now, sorry, Susan, to keep you on hold there for a while. But this was something I had to deal with today. Susan Lindauer, nice to have you with us today.
Hi there. What a fascinating story. What a remarkable testimonial. I am so impressed.
Well, thank you. Susan, we need to hear your story. I'm going to shut up, say nothing at all. I'm just going to lead you in to you were a person seeking to protect the interests of the United States as citizens from assault and from any foreign force. You were part of the U.S. intelligence agencies. You found the truth about 9/11 before 9/11 and be detailed. Then you couldn't get anyone to do anything about it. And then you were arrested under the Patriot Act for trying to speak out. Tell us your story, please.
This is very significant. And it makes a lie. I want everyone to pay attention to what Richard Clark is saying and what George Tenet is saying. And as you listen to me, you're going to hear that parts of what they're saying are true. Richard Clark is about to make an announcement. There's about to be a big radio show where he's going to say that approximately 50 people knew about 9/11 before it happened and that they were tied to the CIA. This is important in that he is finally acknowledging that the CIA had advanced warning about 9/11 and that there was discussions about it. I agree with him on that point, except that he says it's 50 people. I would say it was 150 or 200 people. But at this point, I'm just really happy that somebody is acknowledging the CIA had advanced knowledge. Here is where Richard Clark is wrong. He has attacked George Tenet, the former director of the CIA, in saying that the CIA tried to conceal that information, that advanced knowledge about 9/11, from the Bush administration, from the president and the vice president. He is playing out a standard protection strategy where intelligence takes the blame and the political players, the leaders of the country, are protected from the responsibility for their actions. So the intelligence community sometimes sets itself up to shield politicians from accountability to the people. In this case, that is a huge error, and George Tenet is correct that it is totally dishonest. And here's what really happened. Okay, so as I'm talking, think about Richard Clark, and Richard Clark is going to talk about pilots and whether the CIA tried to recruit them. It is my opinion that these people had been assets, and that the CIA was infiltrating the 9/11 conspiracy. But that does not mean they wanted it to happen. And as you listen to what my story, you'll get a different sense of what the leadership was doing, and how this whole thing played out. Okay. First of all, I was first told about the 9/11 conspiracy in April of 2001. It's important to know that I had been a longtime intelligence asset working in anti-terrorism, covering Iraq and Libya at the United Nations. And I was a direct back channel to those governments. Going back to, in Libya, I established contact with Libya in 95. May of 95. I established contact with Iraq in August of 96. So by the time 9/11 comes along, we've had an extensive, deep, long relations. I have a lot of experience doing this. I am heavily supervised by the CIA and the Defense Intelligence Agency. Nobody should ever think that I was just some little female running around New York, you know, playing around with ambassadors and diplomats on the United Nations Security Council. Everything I did was being scrutinized very heavily. Okay, that and whether you like that or not, that is the job of the CIA. And in my situation, both, and it's very important to know this, both Libya and Iraq knew from the very first meeting that I wanted to be a back channel. I approached them, I told them what the game was, how it would work, and they had to agree. So this is not something where I'm sneaking around, sneaking past them. It's not a covert back channel in that regard. This is a direct, you know, if I'm having a message from the president and the White House and the CIA, I'm telling them it's from the White House and the CIA, and they know to expect it. Okay, so in April of 2001, my CIA handler, Dr. Richard Fuse, for those who want to know, it's F-U-I-S-Z, for those who want to check him out. He's a fascinating character. Richard Fuse contacted me and said he had a message that he wanted me to deliver to the Iraqi embassy, and he wanted me to go up to New York and deliver it right away. So he said he wanted me to come to his office and get the message, so I did. Now, we had weekly meetings anyway, and we spoke on the phone every single day, Monday through Friday. Sometimes we spoke twice a day. And he said to me that he had a message, special message. The United States government was looking for any intelligence on airplane hijackings with a probable strike on the World Trade Center. And we wanted to know if the Iraqi, we wanted to ask the, to request that the Iraqis forward any actionable intelligence regarding airplane hijackings and a strike on the World Trade Center. And if they did, they should send that through the back channel. And Richard said, if the attack occurred, and it was later determined that Iraq had discovered the intelligence and had not sent it to us, then the United States would declare war on Iraq. So we wanted to make sure that they understood this was more than just a simple request like, hey, if you get anything, let us know. Okay. Well, at the time that all this was going on, Iraq had already invited the FBI to send a task force into Baghdad with authorization to conduct terrorism investigations. So, when I go up to New York in April of 2001 and tell them this, their reaction was very positive. They said, okay, we'll be happy to tell Baghdad, and, you know, we have invited the FBI to send a task force into Iraq, and you're welcome to send them and get this information yourself. Sure, we don't see any problem. So I go back to Richard Fuse, and I deliver this message. I'm very, you know, positive. It's a very positive conversation, in my opinion. And Richard Fuse said, what did they say? And I said, oh, I was really nice, and they were very agreeable. He said, I didn't tell you to be nice. I told you to tell those SOB blankety blanker MFers, towelhead blankety blanker, you know, really lots of obscenities, screaming, ranting, storming around his office. I had never seen Richard Fuse so angry. And he said, I don't want you to be nice. I want you to go back and tell them we're going to declare war on them if this happens and they don't tell us about it. And I said, well, Richard, you know, I mean, they may not know it. You have, I've delivered the message. And he said, no, you didn't deliver the message. You were nice about this. We are not being nice about this. We want them to get this information for us. We think that if they come across it and they don't give it to us, we're going to bomb them back to the Stone Age. And this is very important. He said, I want you to tell them the message comes from the highest levels of government above the CIA director, that would be George Tenet, and above the Secretary of State, that would be Colin Powell. And there are only three members of the government who are above those individuals. That would be, as your audience can figure out, President George Bush, Vice President Dick Cheney, and Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. Now, I'm sure that there was a cabal around those men who supported their decisions. However, what was very interesting is that from the very top, that the CIA was emphasizing that this was a deliberate threat.
I just want to mention that some of our stations will be signing off now. They don't carry a full 60 minutes. For those who wish to continue listening to Susan Lindauer talk about how everyone who was significant in the CIA, the White House, the Defense Department knew in advance of 9/11. that there be planes, where they'd be flown into. They knew all this. They've been lying, and she has absolute proof of it. But then because they couldn't threaten her, she refused to shut up about this. They arrested her, one of the very first persons arrested under the Patriot Act, put her in prison. We're going to talk about this.
On a Texas military base.
This is a military base. We're going to talk about this. You can go to progressiveradionetwork.com to continue listening. That's progressiveradionetwork.com. If you forget that, GaryNoll.com. And for all the other stations who are signing off, we thank you for listening. Please continue. And if you could just accelerate the pace, because we want to get to who was involved, that you found was involved in this. How did they plan? Did they actually take it down? And you believe that there was inside the building explosions. What proof do you have, and what, where does that evidence lead you?
Okay. Well, I will say very quickly then, throughout the summer, we talked about the 9/11 conspiracy continuously. Practically every week, Richard Fuse would be agitated when I arrived. He would say, you know, do you understand the seriousness of this? Susan, we're looking at a war situation. And at the time we were working on a comprehensive peace framework with the Iraqis, which you have never been told about either. There was actually a brilliant strategy by the CIA that would have resolved the entire conflict. It would have gotten the United States weapons inspections, cooperation with anti-terrorism, including getting the FBI into Baghdad. Iraq had already agreed to this. The CIA was demanding that all corporations that had been doing business in Iraq would have authorization to go back into the country at the and function at the level they were at before the first Gulf War. They wanted special preferential contracts for U.S. corporations in telecommunications, transportation, factory construction for non-dual-use factory work. They demanded that the Iraqis agreed to buy 1 million American manufactured automobiles every year for 10 years. When I laughed at this, they said, what, do you want 20 years? We'll give you 20 years. And I said, I think the CIA will be very happy. Iraq offered the United States preferential contracts in oil and guarantees of oil, of primary first-tier oil contracts in all new development concessions. There was no reason to take anything away from other countries. France and Russia and the other countries, South Korea, would have continued to hold their own contracts. But there was so much business to do. The United States would have been the first to have hospital care, hospital equipment, pharmaceuticals,
Susan, I got to direct you back to the point, please.
Sure.
We can have a part two of this and go into all these sidebars.
Yeah.
But you're missing the most important point. Let me ask you, now I'm going to have to get involved. Short answers, if you would, please.
Sure.
All right. Do you believe that the people that we were told was going to behind this, did they do it all themselves, or did they have any accomplices inside our government?
Oh, the CIA had total... Here's how this went down. The CIA had total knowledge of the event before it happened. The CIA was prepped to accept that a war with Iraq would follow the attack, and therefore that created motivation for a second team, what I would call an orphan team, that supported the concept of war, to go in and wire the buildings, and to make sure that it would achieve a maximum devastation, maximum destruction, because we all knew the timing of we knew exactly how the attack would occur, and we knew the timing of the attack. On August 2nd, the day of Robert Mueller's Senate nomination hearings, I was told by my CIA handler, Richard Fuse, to stay out of New York because the attack was imminent and we expected mass casualties and the possible use of a miniature thermonuclear device. And I actually went out, and where the CIA got stumped was that I told some private citizens who were not government employees, that they should stay out of New York City. And so when the CIA tried to cover up and protect the politicians, they were then exposed because the private civilians said, she told us about this stuff, and we're not going to keep our mouths shut either.
Okay, Susan, a few more. Do you believe Mossad had anything to do with this?
Yes.
Okay.
Mossad wanted this. Mossad wanted the attack. Had the most to gain from a successful maximum destruction of the towers. And I was told by my CIA handler on the day that 9/11 happened. And I want to be clear: this is the first building had fallen. The second building was still standing. And he told me. He said to me, I was in my living room, and he was in his living room. We were shouting at the TVs, and he said to me, how often do you think that two people, a man and a woman, and here's I want to emphasize what he said. How often do you think a man and a woman are standing on a street corner with a video camera queued up to record a car accident? Susan, it never happens. At best, their hands are whipping around, and they can't. You know, they're catching the end of the attack, the end of the car accident, and it's very fuzzy. And he said, this video is they've got stable hands, and they're just sitting there waiting for this attack to occur.
Okay,
said,
Susan, was it true or not? Was it true or not that different people, different Jewish people at the World Trade Center, were told to stay away? That's been a constant rumor. That's been denied as nonsense. Is there any truth in it?
I don't know if Jewish people were told to stay out of the building. I do not
okay,
know
good.
That.
All right, no, that's fine. Don't tell me what.
But,
don't speculate if you don't know.
Sure.
I'm only asking for what
sure,
you can
no,
prove.
Sure, no, that's all right. That's
I only
all right.
Have another. But, I only have another minute because we're running out of time. I'm going to ask our follow-up guest, Mike Fader, to please understand the importance of just a couple more questions here.
Sure.
Next. Very important. Do you believe that any agency or people within any agency, the United States government, engaged in putting thermitic device in those buildings to cause them to explode and come down?
Yes, absolutely.
Can
this
you
was,
prove
this
it?
This was military-grade weapons. The buildings burned under the core. Okay, underground, the fires burned at the core of the building from until December, and some have said February. Okay.
Is that merely your belief, or do you have any proof?
Well, that's a fact. That's a fact that they burned.
No, it's a fact that they burned. It's not a provable fact that you can say that someone from our governmental agencies did this. I'm merely asking you, could you provide any hard
evidence? Well, okay. I can
evidence.
Also tell you that we know that something strange happened for 10 days that has never been reported, that I have just reported on Veterans Today. The from August 23rd until September 3rd, give or take a day, at 3:00 in the morning, strange vans were captured on the parking security cameras arriving at the World Trade Center. Enough research was done to determine that these vans had never come to the World Trade Center in any period before this time. This was an exclusive event. Their behavior was not explained by any janitorial services or special building maintenances that had been declared to Larry Silverstein. They were able to identify the trucks by color, make, model, and I guess they had no emblems on them at all. But they were able to distinguish that the janitorial trucks had already left the building before they arrived. And so, They were coming at approximately 3 o'clock, right after the janitorial trucks had left the building, and then they were leaving at about 5 a.m. Right before the AAA New York personalities were arriving at the World Trade Center. And there, it has been speculated, and the people who told me this are convinced that those vans were carrying some activating agent.
Okay, but that's speculation.
For bringing down
Susan,
the building.
Susan,
there may
we're
have
out
been
of
other things already there, but this was like the, this was to,
okay,
to make sure the building would come down.
Susan, we're going to have to end it here. Here's what I want to do. I'm going to invite you back tomorrow. because I didn't have a chance to ask some of the most important questions because I wanted you to roll out your story. How is it that you were kept imprisoned at the Carswell Air Force Base in Fort Worth, Texas, without a trial or even a hearing, and threatened with indefinite detention, forcibly drugged? And after 5 years of indictment without conviction or guilty plea, the Justice Department dismissed all charges in five days before President Obama's inauguration. I want to ask you about that, all right?
Okay.
Not now. I also want to ask you, I want more proof. I want absolute documentation on our program. The documentation must be forensic. As if you were in a court.
I don't have forensic documentation. What I have is witness testimonies
that
I warned them about.
Witness testimony is good enough for us because as long as it's not hearsay, it's you having met with a CIA official government agent, and that official government agent says, you tell them there's going to be an attack on 9/11. Here's who's going to be involved.
We'll go into all that.
Okay.
I loved your show. I think what you did was very important today, and I'm looking forward to continuing this tomorrow.
We will continue tomorrow, Susan. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Sorry for running over and torn.
That's all right. It was a great show.
Susan Lindenauer is my guest. Again, Susan is a former U.S. intelligence officer. She covered anti-terrorism at the Iraqi embassy. She did it for years. And then she had stories firsthand, first person, top of the government, inside the intelligence agency that showed that there was going to be attack. So now we have a piece of the puzzle. I didn't know any of this about America was going back into Iraq, and we had the whole solution to Iraq. And no war in Iraq. No war in Afghanistan. None of this would have to have happened. So now we have to dig deeper. That'll be tomorrow. You won't want to miss it. Have a nice day, everyone.
Gary Mel Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matthew Bogart. All shows are archived by Kyle Pollard. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride. And the program director is Jason Tappenfeld.